On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. For months, the talk on Iraq has been all about the surge. Now, it's suddenly all about Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Should he stay or go? Is he America's man in Baghdad or just an empty suit? Some U.S. politicians are calling for regime change. President Bush says the prime minister is a good guy. For his part, Maliki has been hollering back. And now he's struck a big bargain that could, just maybe, inch Iraq forward. Yet the scope of his power is unclear. This hour, On Point, Prime Minister Maliki and Iraq's future. In a moment, we'll speak to some big Iraq watchers stateside. But first today, I'm joined from Baghdad by Carol Williams. She's a foreign correspondent from the Los Angeles Times, and she's been following Prime Minister Maliki closely. Carol, how nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Set the table for us, first off here, Carol, and give us some sense of what the feeling is in Iraq toward Maliki.
Well, I think there's a lot less criticism of him among Iraqis than there is abroad. I mean, the Iraqi voters feel that, you know, he was their choice, or at least his party was their choice when they went to free elections. And I think there's a little bit of resentment building toward the foreign diplomats and politicians who are making hay with their leadership. They may not think a lot of Maliki, but as I said, he's their leader, and they are a little resentful of Washington politicians calling for his ouster and, you know, what they see as interference in their domestic affairs.
So this is sort of get out of our business and let him do his job. Is that the sense?
Well, I don't think that the Iraqi people actually have that much confidence in him. They just are not any more enamored of some of the people who are being proposed as successors to Maliki, like Ayad Alawi and the vice president of the, you know, of the country, the other Shiite politicians. They feel that this has become a sort of political game in Washington, and they're resentful of the intrusion. But that doesn't mean that they necessarily think that Maliki is going to be able to pull the government together and make some success toward reaching the benchmarks that have been set for them.
Speaking of benchmarks, yesterday President Bush praised a new political accord reached by Iraqi leaders and Prime Minister Maliki. Here is the president speaking yesterday in New Mexico about the new compromises. He says they are significant.
The agreement begins to establish new power-sharing agreements, commits to supporting bottom-up security and political initiatives, and advances agreement among Iraq's leadership on several key legislative benchmarks.
Carol Williams, lay out these compromises related to oil and provincial elections, the Baathists coming back into the government. How significant are these compromises?
All the communique did was lay out some areas where the different factions have come to agreement. The primary one, I think, is allowing some low-level former members of the Ba'ath Party, that was Saddam Hussein's political base, to take jobs in teaching and, you know, low-level civil servant jobs. There has been very little forward motion on the most important bills, like the oil revenue sharing framework. The communique that was announced 2 days ago, I believe, was really just an effort by the presidency and the other senior leaders in Iraq to respond to the mounting criticism of Maliki and the mounting calls for his resignation. This was an attempt to make it look like they were coming together. But immediately after it was issued, the Sunni politicians said that they were still boycotting the government and they were not going to take part in cabinet meetings or any of the fora that are necessary to convene to get the legislation passed and the government programs implemented.
What's your sense, Carol, about the level of violence on the ground in Baghdad, especially over the last couple of weeks? Increased or subsided somewhat?
Well, it seems to have decreased a bit in Baghdad, but it's moved elsewhere in Iraq. Right now we're seeing tremendous, you know, chaos unfolding in Karbala, which is the site of a Shiite pilgrimage that culminates today and tomorrow. And there have been clashes between rival Shiite militias. They're saying that there's something like 37 dead now and 60 injured and still bodies laying around the main square of the shrine that haven't even been picked up or counted. There's been, you know, a seeming calm in central Baghdad, but the fear is that the insurgents and the people who were provoking violence and confrontation have simply moved out of the direct line of fire of the surge forces.
And what about this report, Carol, that General Petraeus is set to deliver in September in the United States to Congress about the status of Iraq? How much anticipation is there in Iraq for that report? And is there a sense that it will be a turning point, whatever way it goes?
Except at the political leadership level, I'm not sure how much it's a talked about event among Iraqis. This is something that is much more of interest in Washington and in the United States as American voters look to the report to see whether there's going to be a continued commitment to the war in Iraq and the troop level that exists right now, which is about 160,000 American soldiers on the ground. Iraqis are more concerned that the troops who are here get their security forces trained up and in a position to take over responsibility for their own safety and security than they are about the political, commitment and financial commitment of the American government.
Carol Williams, Los Angeles Times Baghdad correspondent. Carol, I appreciate your time from Baghdad today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Joining me now from Washington is James Dobbins. He's director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He served as Assistant Secretary of State under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. Under Clinton, he was special envoy to Bosnia, Haiti, Kosovo, and Somalia. And under Bush, he was the administration's first envoy to Afghanistan. James Dobbins, nice to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's your assessment of Nouri al-Maliki? How's he doing governing Iraq?
Well, Maliki was a compromise candidate. He's not a representative of the largest party in the parliament, and he's not the head of the party that he does represent. All of the parties that that prevailed in the elections tended to send second-order figures into the government, while their more senior figures stood back and watched events. Maliki is not a commanding figure. He doesn't command a high degree of respect, particularly from people from other parties. And the sectarian passions in the country are running so strongly that it's extremely difficult to manage a multi-ethnic government of national reconciliation, in effect, that he's trying to run.
So can you imagine a scenario then, James Dobbins, where Maliki steps aside? And if so, who might take his place?
Well, I think if Washington saw a way of replacing Maliki with somebody more effective, they'd probably be tempted to move in that direction. But this is a parliamentary system, and unless there's going to be a coup of some sort, and that doesn't appear likely, it would have to be based on somebody who could command a majority in the parliament. The Shia parties. Maliki is of one of the two main Shia parties, or three, I guess, at the moment. Would have to dominate any government because they represent more than 50% of the population and more than 50% of the parliament. There are one or two other figures that the United States would probably be more comfortable with, but it's not clear that they could or would want to take over from Maliki at this point.
How much has Maliki become a scapegoat, if you will, a punching bag for America's failures in Iraq?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that the Iraqi government's failures are real enough. But there is, a tendency in the United States to blame it on the Iraqis. For a long time, Democrats blamed the Republicans for the war and for the failures there, and the Republicans tended to blame the Iraqis. Then, when the Democrats got a hold of got control of Congress, they began to impose benchmarks which would require Iraqi performance. The Iraqis aren't going to meet most of those benchmarks, so pretty soon it'll be the Democrats blaming the Iraqis for failure in Iraq, and then the Republicans can blame the Democrats.
So how can the U.S., with all this blaming going around, be most effective in helping Maliki at this point?
I think that that General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker are largely doing the right things. I think the tactics that General Petraeus has brought with him are classic counterinsurgency tactics of a sort that the United States learned in Vietnam and then promptly forgot. The emphasis on protecting the population, increasing public security, is something that we should have been doing 4 or 5 years ago.
We're talking this hour about the recent tensions between the United States and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. I'd like to hear a little bit from President Bush. Last week, he had a lot of different things to say about Nouri al-Maliki. Speaking in Canada, he first acknowledged dissatisfaction with Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki.
I think there's a certain level of frustration with the leadership in general, inability to work, to come together to get, for example, an oil revenue law passed or provincial elections.
And then a day later, President Bush voiced support for Maliki after the frustration we heard the day before.
Prime Minister Maliki's a good guy, good man, with a difficult job, and I support him. And it's not up to the politicians in Washington, D.C., to say whether he will remain in his position. That is up to the Iraqi people, who now live in a democracy and not a dictatorship.
After those comments, Nouri al-Maliki shot back that the Iraqi people elected him.
Everyone knows that the Iraqi government was elected by the Iraqi people, and nobody can impose timetables or deadlines on it. The only people who can do that are the Iraqis who elected the government.
So, with that as a backdrop, I bring in James Dobbins again, a director at the RAND Corporation and an assistant secretary of state under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. James Dobbins, what do you make of this first back and forth by President Bush and then the response by Nouri al-Maliki?
Well, I think that Bush's initial statement probably reflected his true feelings, that is, the feelings of frustration, and his second reflected his considered view that he wouldn't that expressing those frustrations more more explicitly wouldn't yield productive results, that he didn't have a better alternative to Maliki available, and therefore there was no point in further weakening his position.
I'd like to add to what you have said, James, and bring in from New York, Nir Rosen, who is a journalist and fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also the author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. Nir, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've heard what James Dobbins has said. You've been listening to our correspondent, the Los Angeles correspondent in Baghdad. You've heard the sound from President Bush and al-Maliki. What do you make of all this right now?
Well, we entered Iraq in an illegal war, overthrowing Saddam. Then we imposed a dictator, Iyad Alawi, Paul Bremer. Then we imposed a new dictator, Iyad Alawi. Then when we succumb reluctantly to Iraqi pressure to have elections, and Ibrahim al-Jafari wins, in 2006 we remove him. Remember, Condoleezza Rice and British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw came in there, flew to Baghdad and insisted that Jafari be removed, and instead they put in Maliki, who, of course, was a close ally of Jafari. And now we're dissatisfied with him, and we hear calls for his removal. We hear talk of a potential coup. Even the French foreign minister is now calling for Maliki's removal. So it's outrageous that we have this arrogance to think that we have the right to dictate events within Iraq. And it's also stupid because it just doesn't matter. It all stems from a misunderstanding of the situation in Iraq. You could put anybody you wanted inside the green zone, he would have no power. Power has always resided, since the occupation began, in the hands of different militias in the streets of Iraq. And the green zone has always been a theater. Moreover, if you simply replace the elected official, you're not going to replace his constituency. Maliki was elected, or his party was elected, by the overwhelming majority of Shias, who are the majority of Iraqis, who support a sectarian Shia Islamist sort of government. Of course, they're trying to implement some sort of sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, of other parts of Iraq, from Sunnis. And we are powerless to do anything about this. This is a situation we created, and it's laughable to think that the occupier can criticize the occupied for not being the kind of occupied people that he wishes them to be.
Well, Neil, let me go back to this issue of power, because we hear so much about Nouri al-Maliki, but is all the focus on him the real issue here? Because, as you say, the real power has been decentralized, and the militias are such a powerful presence now. How much of the power base is still in Baghdad, and how much of it has been decentralized and resides in places like Basra and Kirkuk and sort of the more provincial areas?
Well, in the past, when Baghdad was Iraq's major city, or only major city, it was indeed true that you could merely replace a leader in Baghdad, and then you'd have a new government and people would follow, and that's why Iraq has a history of so many coups. However, these days, Iraq is a collection of sort of city-states. You have Baghdad, Basra, Najaf, Karbala, Tikrit, Kirkuk, Erbil, Sulaymaniyah, Bakuba, all of them basically independent with their own warlords ruling them, their own militias, and of course you have the hinterland, and you also have Ramadi, Fallujah, where other militias run rampant, and Iraq is generally a lawless place where power is in the hands of local militias, and sometimes that's the police or the army, but they too are militias. Sometimes it's the American military, and they too are just one more militia among the many militias of Iraq. But really, events in Baghdad don't matter apart from Baghdad, unfortunately. And the people in the Green Zone have no power. There is no Iraqi government. What you have is a few parties who control a few ministries. And the leaders of these parties are much more powerful than the ministers that they put in the into the government. The militias obey the dictates of the party leaders, whether the Supreme Islamic Council, whether Muqtada Sadr's people, whether Dawah, Sunni parties the same way. And real power lies in the hands of these local warlords.
Well, having said all that, Nir, you know, there's a new report that suggests that the government in Iraq will become even more precarious over the next few months. And so the question then leads, what will the new challenges bring then? And what's the answer?
Well, there is no answer. The answer perhaps is to declare Iraq lost for the U.S. to apologize to the Iraqi people and somehow hope to contain the conflict, because the future of Iraq is basically Mogadishu, leaving aside Kurdistan. You're going to have small warlords controlling local areas. In areas that are closer to important resources such as oil installations, you'll have more powerful warlords backed by China, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, doesn't matter who. These days, the main concern is containing Iraq, because Iraq is no longer just Iraq. It's a regional conflict. It's going to involve Jordan and Syria and Lebanon. 3 million refugees already left Iraq since the occupation began. 3 million Iraqis displaced. Iraq is destroyed. It doesn't exist as a state anymore, and it's going to drag in Jordan and Syria into it potentially. Islamic Sunni militias being pushed out of Baghdad towards the Anbar province may link up with Islamist parties in Syria or Jordan. The refugees may well destabilize the very delicate demographic and sectarian balances in Syria and Jordan. Mm-hmm. It's happening mm-hmm. in Lebanon too. Iran and Saudi Arabia could end up being driven to into open conflict, and Jordan as well, inside Iraq. So what I think is going to happen is a much larger conflict.
Let me go back to James Dobbins. Near you mentioned Iran. Today a story crossed the wire quoting the president of Iran, warning that a power vacuum is imminent in Iraq and that Iran is ready to fill that gap. So, James Dobbins, is there a sense in places like Iran and elsewhere of this our disappointment in Maliki? And will we be even more disappointed in the reaction to that?
Well, I think there is concern on the part of all the neighboring states at the growing the lack of security and impending chaos in Iraq. Some are better able to cope with it than others. Iran is probably the most able to cope with it because it's the largest and most powerful of Iraq's neighbors. But nevertheless, it can't be indifferent to what's going on there. It also has strong ties to the dominant forces in Iraq, the Shia, and has been assisting some of the Shia militias to the United States' discomfort. I think it's also true that the only hope of stabilizing Iraq is to afford some kind of consensus among the neighboring governments about what kind of Iraq should be stabilized. The main problem with American policy in Iraq, or a main problem for the last several years, has been the thought that we could do this on our own, that somehow we could promote a project in Iraq that was opposed by nearly all of Iraq's neighbors and hope to succeed. I think that's proved wrong, and unless the United States makes a major effort, as it did in the Balkans in the 90s and in Afghanistan in 2001, to promote a regional project for Iraq stabilization, there's not much hope of success.
Maliki had a lot to say this weekend, lashing out at the U.S. and French politicians, oddly, who have called for him also to step down. Maliki dismissed calls for his resignation as, quote, ugly interference in Iraq's domestic affairs. He said, quote, there are American officials who consider Iraq as if it were one of their villages, for example, Hillary Clinton and Carl Levin, end quote. Is Maliki getting bolder in talking back to the U.S., and does that give him some sort of odd credibility in Iraq and in the region, James Dobbins?
Well, I don't think he has to be too bold to talk back to Democratic politicians who are running for president, particularly since he probably has President Bush's support in that criticism. But he clearly is sensitive to these criticisms, and he wants to make sure that there isn't any receptivity to them in Iraq itself.
Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners into this conversation. Many want to join. James is first, calling from Nashville. Hi, James. You're on the line.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I just called because I believe that Hillary Clinton and Carl Levin both owe Maliki an apology, because I think that they're trying to interfere with another government when they have no right to do so. And it's ironic to me, because they can't even, our government is incompetent in that itself and can't get nothing accomplished here. And yet they're trying to tell another government how to do things and what to do. And that's, I believe, just cause for more problems.
James, thanks so much for your thoughts. Nir Rosen, I had a question for you about Maliki's challenge as far as the Sunni and Shia are concerned in this fragmented state that is Iraq. Sunnis will never support him because he's a Shia, and I've been hearing more and more that the Shia don't like him because he's not Shia enough. Is this an insurmountable challenge, really, for anyone to
overcome? Well, it's
not
that Sunnis won't support him because he's a Shia. Sunnis won't support him because he's part of a Shia Islamist sectarian coalition that has basically allowed for the removal of Sunnis from Baghdad, whether from Baghdad's neighborhoods or from Iraqi ministries. It's been a very successful and systematic cleansing of Sunnis from Iraq. The majority of the Iraqi refugees are Sunnis these days. So I think were he a more nationalist figure, a less sectarian figure, he may have had their support, but Sunnis really feel targeted and vulnerable. Indeed, you do hear criticism coming from some Shia circles that he's not sufficiently sectarian as a Shia, criticism that he would make any deals with Sunnis. But I don't really take those deals seriously, because they mean nothing. Every other week we hear of a new compromise with Sunni politicians. It doesn't amount to anything, because there's no reason. When you're getting a divorce, why would you want to give the other side anything at all? I mean, the plan, and it's been a successful plan, has been to remove Sunnis from Baghdad, from the center, from the south, push them towards the Anbar province, push them out of Iraq.
James Dobbins, given what Nir Rosen just said, is Nuri al-Maliki unable or unwilling to bring these factions together?
I suspect some combination of the two, but I think it would be difficult for almost anybody to bring these factions together, given the passions that have been aroused, the degree of antipathy that's been created by the violence. I don't know that al-Maliki is intentionally backing a conspiracy of the sort we've just heard described, but I think the description is an accurate one of what is in fact going on.
AJ is on the line now from Potsdam, New York, to join this conversation. AJ, hi.
Jane, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think we just need to stop rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, cut our losses, and realize that we have long overstayed our welcome, And it is time, as Mr. Rosen and Mr. Dobbins have pointed out, bring in the regional players and do what we can to help them stabilize their region and their neighbor, Iraq. And I'm afraid, just have to let the chips fall where they may. The Iraqi people are going to have to salvage their country from the mess we have made of it. And unfortunately, it will fall on the next president, because it's clear that Bush, his handlers, and minions have no intention of extricating the United States from this disaster. I think Mr. Rosen was quite correct when he referred to this as an illegal war, which I am certain history will adjudge it to have been. The next president will have to bring in the regional players, and yes, that includes Iran. There are responsible people to deal with, and they have to be the major players we have.
All right, AJ, let me turn that to James Dobbins. What about it? Bring in the regional players, including Iran, and let the chips fall where they may? Good idea, bad idea?
Well, I think the first is necessary. I'm not sure what let the chips fall where they may really means in this kind of situation. You've got 25 million people whose fate to some degree hangs on how the United States extricates itself, and whether it can do so in a responsible fashion, and whether it can do so in a way that leaves behind a reasonably stable situation. So I think there aren't any easy answers, but I do think that engaging the regional states and trying to put together a concerted effort and a common picture of what Iraq should look like should be the administration's top priority at the moment. And I'm sorry, it's doing it, but it's doing it in a rather half-hearted fashion, because it has a contending priority, which is containing Iran and building a Sunni coalition around Iran to prevent an expansion of its influence. And you can't do both at the same time, I'm afraid, successfully.
Back to Nouri al-Maliki. For the moment, Nir Rosen, it seems Washington has little choice but to stick with him. Agree?
Well, they can try to overthrow him, as I said. I mean, I do think that there are many who have that ambition. I think it would be rejected by the Iraqi people, and I think it would be ineffective.
I'd like now to add another voice to the conversation. Joining me from Washington is Fred Kagan. He's a military historian and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's just back from a July trip to Iraq. Fred, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
So you're just back from Iraq. You were just there. What's your sense about how well the political process is moving forward with Maliki as prime minister?
Well, I think that we're all looking too quickly to try to see what's going on in the political process. The premise of the new strategy was that we would create space for the political process to move forward. And we need to keep in mind that the major military operations of the surge began in June. It's been about 2.5 months. A lot of that in the summer with the parliament on recess. I know people are upset about that. That's what parliaments normally do in summer.
But in a case like this?
Well, and the negotiations have been going on even while they've been in recess. A new coalition was formed. They've been negotiating. They just announced the fruits of another negotiation. It's not as though nothing has been happening there. But I think it's too soon to tell. The premise was that once we had established security, it would be easier for Iraqis to make compromises that will necessarily put them at a disadvantage in a future civil war. And the only way to get them to do that is really to take the issue of civil war off the table. 2.5 months is not enough time to do that.
Well, you say it's not enough time. Historically, are there other examples you can point to of military operations that have paved the way for political success in a case like this?
Well, most wars end when military operations create circumstances where the warring factions have come together in agreements. That's usually how wars end. I'm reluctant to get into specific historical examples. I think there are some, but then we just get into nitpicking how they're all similar or different, and I don't really think that that's very constructive. The key thing is, looking at the situation in Iraq, do we see a possibility for this to move in the right direction or not. And I think that we see some very encouraging signs. And to me, by far the most encouraging sign has been the development of grassroots movements and the fact that the Maliki government has reached back to some of those movements and is working to incorporate those guys into the Iraqi government and into the Iraqi political system. That's incredibly important. And
are you
I really
speaking
think
of the Baathists back to the government? Is that who you're referring to?
Well, not the Baathists so much as the reaching out to the grassroots Sunni movements in Anbar, Salahuddin, Diyala, Babil, and Baghdad, allowing these guys to come into the Iraqi security forces, which is what they've been asking to do, which is very notable. Maliki's made a number of visits to these provinces, has been promising aid. Some money has been flowing. There have been discussions between the government and leading sheikhs in these areas trying to solidify the relationship between the government and these people who are coming in from the insurgency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are tremendously important developments. But again, they're going to take some time to play out.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned these grassroots movements. We also mentioned this news yesterday of this political accord reached by Iraqi leaders regarding oil and holding provincial elections, also allowing the Baathists back into the government. Are you optimistic that Parliament will actually pass these measures?
Well, I will say that I'm neutral about it. I don't, we've seen accords before in the past of this variety announced. Then it turns out that there are various different caveats. The Iraqis seem to have an easier time announcing these things than following through on them, which is understandable. I mean, we do want to keep in mind that you're asking the Iraqi politicians to make compromises that they find in principle totally unacceptable. And that's not that unusual. I mean, we do that in our own politics, too. But it's going to be very painful, and I think the political tension is going to rise before we come to a conclusion. But it's nevertheless a positive sign that they have been working on this and that they did come up with something, that Hashemi was actually up there willing to stand behind this agreement, even though he said he's not coming back into the government. It's a good sign to see Hashemi involved in this at all.
Mm-hmm. General David Petraeus is going to be reporting to Congress coming up in September about the progress in Iraq. There was hope that benchmarks would be met by that point. We're hearing more and more calls on both sides of the aisle to pull troops out, even calls for Maliki to step down. You're saying we're expecting too much too quickly. So then I ask you, what is an acceptable timetable, in your opinion, in Iraq?
For what?
For success at the political level.
I think that you would have to look for this sort of progress over the course of the coming year, and I think that we'll need to continue to track the security situation as that continues to improve, and I think that will continue to improve. The National Intelligence Estimate said they think it will continue to improve, and I think General Petraeus will say that as well. As you see that continuing to improve, and as we continue to take force and violence off the table as a legitimate political expression in Iraq, I think what you will see is that the focus will come to be more and more on the political process, which I think, again, will initially raise tensions. And the first thing that you will see is a lot of rhetoric rising as people realize that they really are going to have to fight their way through a lot of hard compromises. But I do think that that process will work out over the coming months, one way or another, with Maliki, without Maliki. I don't think we need to be particularly focused on whether there's a change of government over there. But I think that it will, this is something that can happen over the course of 2008. It's politics. It's unpredictable. You don't know. You can never predict anything with certainty. But I think it's quite possible.
Nir Rosen, fellow at the New America Foundation's journalist, spent more than 2 years in Iraq reporting on post-war politics there. What's your response to what Fred Kagan is saying?
Well, I think any optimistic sentiments when it comes to Iraq are bound to be naive after 3 years that I've spent there. The fact that some violence may have gone down in Baghdad is for two reasons. One, of course, violence has been relocated or dislocated elsewhere to the villages that are unprotected. But more importantly, the violence had its own logic. The logic was to push Shias out of Sunni neighborhoods, to push Sunnis out of Shia neighborhoods. That's basically been done. So they weren't going to go killing each other forever. The goal of sectarian removal, especially when it comes to Sunnis from Baghdad and other Shia areas, has been basically achieved. So you're not going to find as many bodies on the street and so forth. But that's not a sign of success. That's a sign of the utter failure of the U.S. project in Iraq and of the eventual, I think, dismemberment of Iraq.
Let's go back to the phones now to Davenport, Iowa, and Carol, who's on the line. Hi, Carol. Well, nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yes, I have a comment more than a question.
I'm not understanding, first off, we went into Iraq with no plan of how to get out. And now we wring our hands as to how we are going to get out. To me, it's really simple. You start pulling people out of Iraq instead of sending people, you know, more people in. We're going to have a report from General Petraeus, and I'm sure that he's going to say things are fine there and then give some negatives as well.
Well, let me turn to James Dobbins. James, when you hear calls to start pulling U.S. troops from Iraq, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that given the levels of support both in Iraq and in the United States for a continued American troop commitment, some reduction over the next year is inevitable. I think it's also inevitable for reasons having to do with the pressure on our armed forces and the inability to sustain current numbers. So I think the numbers are going to come down. The question is whether they come down rapidly or slowly. Personally, I would like to see them come down in a fairly continuous but also orderly fashion. But I do believe that unless this is combined with a much more vigorous effort at regional diplomacy designed to get other countries to begin telling the Iraqi politicians the same thing we're telling them, rather than giving them conflicting and contrary advice, it's not going to make much difference whether we stay quickly or go.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones with Miles, who has a question now from Potsdam, New York. Hi, Miles, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
There was a clip that you played of President Bush early in the program in which he referenced the, quote, oil sharing law that is stalled. I have read that part of the oil sharing is among the Iraqis, but part of the oil sharing is how the Iraqis are going to share their oil with American and British oil companies. And I've read that this is a stumbling block for the Iraqis because they don't want to accept the sweetheart deals that are in that legislation. Are any of your guests knowledgeable about that oil law and what kind of deals are in there for our oil companies?
Miles, thanks so much. Any on the table want to discuss oil regulation?
Well, I can talk about it some. I don't know what specific deals are in that legislation. The issue is the Iraqi oil industry requires heavy foreign investment in order to be developed to back to its capability and beyond. And the whole, in fact, the most important aspect of the oil law is creating a legal basis in which that kind of investment can take place securely from the financial standpoint, which could be a very good thing because it turns out that there are significant oil reserves in the Sunni province of Anbar. And, you know, as people have pointed out, the Sunni are uncomfortable because they don't control very many of the oil-bearing areas of Iraq. It would be very good to get investment going. Now, there has been a lot of dispute within Iraq about what kind of foreign investment they're willing to tolerate and how they want that to be set up and so forth. But it's not really talking about sharing Iraq's oil wealth with foreign companies. It's a question of what kind of foreign investment they want to attract and what sort of incentives they want to use to attract it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I wanted to turn the topic to one other issue here. Ayad Alawi, who is a chief rival of Nouri al-Maliki and the prime minister of Iraq right after Saddam Hussein's government fell, told NPR earlier this month that Maliki needs to go. And Alawi has hired a Washington lobbying firm with close ties to the Bush administration to make his case, touching off speculation that regime change in Iraq may be in the works.
I think, unfortunately, Maliki is part of a sectarian system which is influencing and affecting the country negatively.
James Dobbins, your reaction to that and to a chief rival of Maliki hiring a lobbying firm to make his case here and elsewhere?
Well, I think the administration probably would be more comfortable with Alawi if they thought that he could actually effectively govern. Unfortunately, his party received a very small minority of the votes in the last election, which was a great disappointment for Washington. And I don't think there's any sign that support for him or support for his party has grown significantly in Iraq. So he would be governing from a very narrow base. And that makes him a rather implausible candidate, I think.
Fred Kagan, do you want to join that?
Yeah, Alawi has been campaigning actively to replace Maliki for some time, and he's been going from country to country in the Middle East trying to convince everybody that he's our boy. I think the point that Ambassador Dobbins makes is fair, although, of course, Maliki also has a relatively small block within parliament of his own. But I think, you know, we have to understand that we are not in the business of picking Iraq's leaders. We have set up a democratic system in Iraq. We're allowing it to play out. And the snaps that Maliki made at Hillary Clinton and Carl Levin may have been sharper than they would have liked to hear, but there was a certain fairness in that, because we really are beyond the point where we can look at the Iraqis and say, we don't want you to be governed by this guy. We want you to be governed by this guy instead. This is an Iraqi process that they're going to have to play out in a way that works for them. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
Nir Rosen, is it still America's role to recommend regime change?
Well, I think it was never America's role, and it's been a very unsuccessful enterprise until now. And Alawi certainly, as both guests have noted, is not very popular, much like Chalabi, regrettably, because he did espouse a non-sectarian line. But Iraqis remember that he was the prime minister who backed the destruction of Fallujah. Sunnis resent him for that. Shias resent him because he was the one who authorized U.S. military operations against the Mahdi army in various Shia parts of the country, including Najaf. So he's disliked by both sides. And others remember that he was working on behalf of the CIA, that he dispatched car bombs into Iraq. So he's a very unpopular guy, and that's why he has to hire this lobbying firm. And you could replace the leader, but as I said, you can't replace the Iraqi people. And they've been pretty clear that Sunnis want sectarian Sunni parties to govern Iraq, and Shias want sectarian Shia parties to govern Iraq.
Back to the phones for another question from Davenport, Iowa. Gary's on the line. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you.
Sure.
I was calling to make a point that's just been raised to some extent. I find it very offensive, the underlying hypocrisy, to suggest that we're there to spread democracy, and yet we talk about regime change, Alawi, and all those other issues, which undermines the basic democratic principle of self-determination. I think we need to get our troops out of that country, and we need to let the democratic process work, and let those people fend for themselves in the democratic style of choosing their own leader.
Gary, thank you. Fred Kagan, your response?
Well, I agree with the first half of the point, but not the second. We have to let the Iraqi democratic process play out, but it can't happen in the context of the violence that has been going on, sparked very largely by al-Qaeda in Iraq, and also very heavily supported, actively supported by Iran. And to bring it back to a comment that Ambassador Dobbins and other people frequently make about the prospects of regional diplomacy, we need to keep in mind that Iranian-backed proxies have attempted to kill Maliki on a number of occasions and have been attacking government officials in Iraq, and in a variety of ways doing things that go way beyond efforts simply to drive us out of the country. And I'm very skeptical of the notion that there's some way that we could talk to them that would convince them to see the error of their ways in this regard. So I think I'm in favor of letting democracy work out in Iraq. That's why I continue to support a troop presence that will allow us to help the Iraqis maintain the security situation at a level where you can start to have political process work properly.
I'd like to give the last word before we close up our hour to James Dobbins and ask you, Ambassador Dobbins, about what you think the future of the Maliki government is and more broadly the political process in Iraq with about a minute left.
I think it's very difficult to be optimistic at this stage. I think it's possible that Maliki will be replaced as the result of an Iraqi process at some point over the next year or so. It's really going to depend in large measure on whether the dominant Shia factions realign themselves behind another candidate. If that were to occur, the candidate might prove to be more effective than Maliki, or he could, on the other hand, prove to be even more sectarian and promote an even more clear-cut civil war.
James Dobbins, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Nir Rosen, journalist and fellow at the New America Foundation. Nir, great to have you as well.
Thanks.
And Fred Kagan, military historian and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Fred, great to have you.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.